it was still intact and operating, with 41 American officers and about 400 Filipino scouts. Early in the siege, though, cavalry proved ineffective in the treacherous jungles of the peninsula, and the horses were soon needed elsewhere as hunger became an enemy. April 9th, the day of the surrender, the 26th had lost 14 officers and about 200 scouts. At O'Donnell, 36 of the Americans were together, including Sal Moreno and Ewing Kane. Six of the missing were known dead, including Pete Banning. Others had evaded capture and were still at large, including Lieutenant Edwin Ramsey, the leader of the last cavalry charge at Morong. Ramsey was on his way to the mountains, where he would organize a guerrilla army. In charge of the 26th was Major Robert Trumpet, a West Pointer from Maryland. He had arrived at O'Donnell 2 days before Pete and was busy organizing his men into a survival unit. Like everyone else, they were suffering from starvation, dehydration, exhaustion, wounds, and disease, primarily dengue fever and malaria. They had survived the death march and were quickly realizing that they would have to survive O'Donnell as well. Trumpet prepared a list of the 6 men killed either in action or on the march and managed to hand it to an aide for General Ned King. The general had asked all commanders to do this so families back home could be notified. Of the 6, 4 had died in action, with 2 known to have been buried. Pete and another lieutenant had died on the march, and their bodies would never be recovered. General King asked the commandant to pass along the names of the dead and captured to an American administrative staff working under house arrest in Manila. At first, the commandant refused, but later changed his mind when his superiors ordered it. The Japanese were proud of the large numbers of American casualties and wanted it known. The hospital was a collection of flimsy bamboo huts on stilts. There were 5 wards, long buildings with no beds, blankets, or sheets. Patients lay shoulder to shoulder on the floor, some in agony, others in comas, still others already dead. Under manageable conditions, it could safely house 200 patients at a time. By late spring, there were over 800 men lined along the floors, waiting for medicines that were not going to arrive. Most of them would die. Not long after the Bataan prisoners began flooding O'Donnell, the hospital became more of a morgue than a place to be treated. The doctors and medics, most of them also suffering from one or more maladies, had almost no medicine. Even the basics, such as quinine for malaria or paregoric for dysentery, or vitamin C for scurvy, were in urgently short supply. Most of the supplies, tape, gauze, disinfectant, aspirin, and so on, were smuggled in by doctors from other hospitals. The Japanese provided virtually nothing. The doctors were forced to hoard the medicines and give them only to the men who seemed most likely to survive. Giving drugs to a severe case was, in effect, wasting the drugs. As the supplies got thinner, the doctors devised a simple lottery system to determine the winners. Clay dragged Pete back to the hospital and finally managed to corner a doctor. He explained that his friend had not only dysentery but malaria as well and seemed to be fading fast. The doctor said he was sorry, but he had nothing. Clay had heard the rumor, and with so many idle men, the rumor mill raged nonstop, that there was a black market for some of the more common medicines. Clay asked the doctor about this, and he claimed to know nothing. But as they were leaving, the doctor whispered, "Behind Ward 4. Behind Ward 4, sitting under a shade tree, was a plump American with a deck of cards. On a makeshift table, he was playing some type of game that needed only one participant. The fact that he was not emaciated, was clear evidence that he was gaming the system. When they had surrendered, Clay had noticed a few heavier American captives. They were generally older and worked somewhere in the Army's vast administration abyss. When forced to march, many of them had fallen quickly. This guy had not marched anywhere, nor had he missed many meals. He was powerfully built with a thick chest, muscled arms, a squat neck, and a sneer that Clay instantly hated. He dealt some cards to himself, glanced up at Clay, and asked,
"Need something?"
Clay released Pete, who managed to stand on his own and assess the situation. It was one he did not care for. It was one that infuriated him. Clay said,
"Yeah. My friend here needs some quinine and paregoric. Somebody said you got it."
On the table, there were four small bottles of pills next to the deck of cards. The dealer glanced at the bottles and said,
"Got a few pills left, a buck a pop."
Without a word, without a warning, Clay growled,
"You blood-sucking sack of shit."
He attacked, kicking the table and sending the cards and bottles flying. The dealer jumped up, yelled,
"What the hell?"
and threw a roundhouse right at Clay, who was charging. Clay ducked low and with a right uppercut, caught the dealer square in the testicles. As they popped together, he screamed and fell to the dirt. Clay kicked him viciously in the face, then dropped to his knees and pounded away as a blind rage overcame fatigue, starvation, dehydration, and whatever else Clay had at the moment. All was forgotten as he could finally, after days of wanting to fight back and kill the enemy, deliver some resistance and revenge. After a dozen or so shots to the face, he stopped and slowly stood. He said,
"You low-life son of a bitch. Making a buck off men who are dying. You're lower than the damn Japs."
The dealer was not done. He managed to maneuver onto all fours, undoubtedly with more pain in his crotch than in his bloody face, then stood, although unsteadily. He glanced around and noticed that a crowd was gathering. Nothing was more enjoyable than a good fist fight, primarily because so few of the prisoners had the energy to start or finish one. He was bleeding from the nose and the mouth and a cut above his right eye, and he should have stayed on the ground. With a limp caused by his aching balls, he stepped toward Clay and growled,
"You son of a bitch!"
The word "bitch" had barely escaped his mouth when a fist smacked it with such speed that the punch was barely visible. With a perfect left-right combo, Clay drew even more blood. The dealer wasn't much of a boxer and had never brawled with a cowboy. And as they sparred, he had a terrible time landing a punch. Clay circled him, firing away and pretending he was punching a Jap. A hard right to the chin dropped the dealer again. He fell onto the board he'd been using as a table, and Clay, still in a rage, grabbed the board and began pounding his hapless opponents. The sound of hardwood cracking against his skull became sickening, but Clay could not stop. He had seen so much death that life was now cheap, and who in hell cared if he killed a man he considered lower than a Jap? A guard with a bayonet on a rifle stepped next to him and stuck him gently in the back. Clay stopped his pounding, looked at the guard, and stood. He tried to catch his breath and was suddenly exhausted. The guard smiled and said,
"No, stop. Fight more."
Clay looked at the battered face of the dealer. He looked at Pete, who was standing under the tree and shaking his head no. He looked at the gaunt men in the crowd who had hurried over to watch. He looked at the Jap and said,
"Nah, I'm finished."
The guard raised his bayonet, poked Clay in the chest, nodded at the guy in the dirt, and said,
"Kill him."
Clay ignored the bayonet and said,
"No, that's what you do."
He took a step back, fully expecting the guard to lunge at him and begin something awful. But the guard only lowered his rifle and stared at Clay, who walked to the tree to retrieve Pete. The crowd slowly dispersed as the dealer came to his senses and started to move. Pete had found a new best friend. An hour later, they were hiding from the sun behind the barracks. The odors inside their building had become so noxious that they tried to avoid it. Pete was sitting under a tree with Clay nearby. They were chatting with others, whiling away the hours, when the same guard found them. He addressed Clay, who stood and bowed and faced him in anticipation of a bad scene. Instead, the guard pulled a small bottle from his pocket, handed it to Clay, nodded at Pete, and said, "For your friend." Then he turned in a perfect about face and marched away. The pills were quinine, lifesavers for Pete, and a few others in his barracks. Chapter 28. As was her ritual, at 6 p.m., Nineveh left supper on the stove and walked to her cottage. Liza watched her leave through a bedroom window, thankful once again that she was gone and the family was alone. In the 9 years that Liza had lived in the main house, she and Nineveh had learned to coexist, often side by side, as they canned fruits and vegetables from the garden and talked about the children. With Pete gone, they leaned on each other daily, with each trying to appear stronger than the other. In front of the kids, they were stoic and confident that the Allies would win the war and he would be home soon. Both women shed plenty of tears, but always in private. On Tuesday, May 19th, the family was in the middle of supper, and the conversation was about the summer. Vacation began tomorrow, and Joel and Stella were eager to start the 3-month holiday. He was 16, a rising senior, and the youngest in his class. She was 15 and would be a sophomore. They wanted to travel some, perhaps to New Orleans or Florida, but the truth was that no definite plans could be made. They had not heard from their father in over 4 months, and this uncertainty dominated their lives. From just outside the kitchen window, Mac started barking as a wave of headlights swept through the kitchen. A car had approached and was somewhere out front. Since no one was expected, the three gave each other a fearful look. Liza jumped to her feet and said, "Someone is here. I'll see who it is." At the front door were two men in army uniforms. A moment later, they were seated in the den, facing the family on the sofa. Liza sat between Joel and Stella and held their hands. Stella was already in tears. Captain Malone said solemnly, "I'm afraid I have some bad news, and I'm sorry. But Lieutenant Banning is now missing and presumed dead. We do not know for certain that he is dead because his unit was unable to recover his body. But given the circumstances, the men with him are reasonably certain that he is dead. I'm very sorry." Stella's head fell in her mother's lap. Liza grabbed both and squeezed them close. They gasped and cried and held each other tightly as the two officers stared at the floor. The men had not volunteered for this assignment, but they had their orders and were now making such dreadful visits almost every day throughout North Mississippi. Liza gritted her teeth and asked, "What does presumed dead mean exactly?" Captain Malone said, "It means we did not recover the body." "So there's a chance he's still alive?" Joel asked, wiping his cheeks. "Yes, there is that chance. But I caution you that, under the circumstances, the men with Lieutenant Banning are reasonably certain that he was killed." "Can you tell us what happened?" Liza asked.
We have some details, but not many. And I'm not sure how accurate our facts are, ma'am. Lieutenant Banning was captured when the Allied forces surrendered to the Japanese on the Philippines. It was last month on April 9th and 10th. The men were being marched to a POW camp when he was injured and left behind, as were many men. He was then killed by the Japanese soldiers. At that moment, it didn't really matter how he died. The shock of the moment blurred the details. The horrible truth was that Pete Banning was gone, and they would never see him again. Husband, father, patriarch, friend, boss, brother, neighbor, and leading citizen. There were so many who would share their pain. They wept for a long time, and when the officers had nothing else to say, they stood, offered their condolences once more, and left the house. Liza wanted nothing more than to go to her bedroom, lock the door, get under the covers, and cry herself to sleep. But that would be indulgent and was not an option. She had two wonderful children who now needed her more than ever. And while she wanted to collapse into a puddle of tears, she instead stiffened her spine and took the first step. Joel, get in the truck and drive down to Flory's. Bring her back here. Stop along the way and inform Nineveh. Tell Jupe to get on a horse and spread the word among the Negroes. Word spread rapidly enough, and within an hour, the front yard was filled with cars and trucks. Liza would have preferred to spend the first night in quiet mourning with just her kids and Flory, but things were not done that way in the rural South. Dexter and Jackie Bell arrived in the first wave and spent a few moments alone with the Bannings. He read some scripture and said a prayer. Liza explained that the family was not ready to confront a horde of well-meaning mourners, and they huddled in her bedroom while Dexter quietly asked folks to come back later. At 10 o'clock, they were still arriving. In Clanton, the gossip was of nothing else. At 8 a.m., Dexter opened the sanctuary of the Methodist Church so those who knew Pete could stop by for a moment of prayer. In the early hours of the tragedy, much was made of the fact that he was missing and not officially dead. So there was hope, and the hope inspired his friends and neighbors to pray long and hard. Later in the morning, Dexter and Jackie returned to the Banning home to sit with Liza and the children, who were still in no mood to greet the crowd. He quietly encouraged people to leave, and they did. They arrived in carloads and delivered cakes, pies, casseroles, food no one needed, but there were traditions to follow. After a few soft words with Dexter, and once they realized they would not be allowed to hug and cry with Liza, they quietly left the house, returned to their cars, and drove away. Liza made the decision that there would be no memorial service. There was a chance her husband was still alive, and she and her children would focus on that and ignore the bad news. Or they would at least try to. As the days dragged on, Liza began seeing a few close friends, as did Joel and Stella. The shock gradually wore off, though the aching, numbing pain did not. Routines developed to maintain normalcy. The family ate breakfast and supper together, often with Nineveh sitting with them, a new wrinkle. Each weekday, Dexter Bell arrived around 10 for a short devotional, a verse or scripture, a comforting word, and a thoughtful prayer. Jackie came occasionally, but usually he was alone. 2 weeks after receiving the news, Flory took Joel and Stella to Memphis for a long weekend. Liza insisted they go in an effort to get away from the gloominess of their home and to have a little fun. Flory had some eccentric friends in Memphis who could make anyone smile. She and the kids checked into the Peabody, Joel's room was not far from where he was conceived, though he would never know it. While they were away, Dexter Bell arrived each day for the morning devotion. He and Liza sat in the den and talked quietly. From the kitchen, Nineveh listened to every word. Some black market paregoric worked, and Pete's third round of dysentery improved but did not go away. His malaria lingered too. He could function with it, though at times the chills and fevers caused him to lie in the dirt and shake from head to toe. He hallucinated and thought he was back home. He and Clay sat in the shade of the barracks and watched the parade of dead bodies being hauled to the cemetery across the road. By late April, 25 Americans were dying each day. By May, the number was 50. By June, 100. Death was everywhere. The living thought about dying because they saw the dead bodies, which were often piled haphazardly. They thought about dying because they too were facing death. They starved a little more each day and came closer to a collapse from which they would not recover. Diseases were running rampant, and there was no way to stop them, and it was inevitable that one of a dozen would arrive any day now and bring a miserable death with it. Pete watched men give up and die, and on several occasions he was tempted. All of them were hanging on by a thread anyway, and only those with an iron will to live managed to survive. Giving up was painless, while living meant waking up in the morning and facing another day in hell. Some were determined to cling to all hope and survive whatever the enemy threw at them, while others grew too weary from the suffering and closed their eyes. Pete survived by thinking of his wife and kids, his farm, and his family's long and rich history in Ford County. He recalled stories he had heard as a boy about old wars and battles and feuds, all colorful tales that had been handed down from one generation to the next. He thought about Liza and those wonderful days at the Peabody when they were spending nights together, something no well-respected couple would think of doing in the 1920s. He thought of her body and her constant desire for physical pleasure. He remembered hunting and fishing with Joel in the woods on their land and bringing home deer, turkeys, rabbits, brim and crappie that they cleaned by the barn and gave to Nineveh to cook for supper. He remembered Stella as a little girl with those beautiful eyes curled up on the sofa in her pajamas, listening as her father read bedtime stories. He longed for the warmth of her soft skin. He wanted to be there when his children finished college and got married. Pete had made the decision that he would not die from disease or starvation. He was a tough farm boy, a West Point man, a cavalry officer, and he had a beautiful family back home. Perhaps luck had given him a stronger physical and mental constitution. He was tougher than most of the others, or at least he told himself so. He wanted to help the weaker ones, but there was nothing he could do. Everyone was dying, and he had to take care of himself. As conditions worsened at O'Donnell, the men talked more and more of escape. As prisoners, they were expected to attempt it, though in their condition it seemed nearly impossible. They were too weak to run far, and there were Japs everywhere. It would be easy to get outside because of the work crews, but they were not healthy enough to survive in the jungle. To suppress the urge to run, the Japs implemented some rules that were simple in their understanding, but exceedingly brutal in their application. Initially, if you ran and got caught, you were to be struck with a bullwhip until you bled to death. To demonstrate how this rule worked, The guards rounded up several thousand prisoners one afternoon for a show near the commandant's quarters. Five Americans had tried to escape and been caught. They were stripped naked, and their hands were bound together above their heads and attached to ropes looped over a rail so that their toes barely touched the ground. At first, it looked like they might be hanged. All five were emaciated, with their ribs jutting out. An officer with a bullwhip strutted in front of the prisoners and through an interpreter explained what was about to happen, though it was rather obvious. He was an expert with the bullwhip, and his first stroke against the back of the first soldier caused him to scream. The bullwhip popped with each blow, and his back and buttocks were soon bloodied. When he appeared to be unconscious, the officer moved a few steps to the second soldier. The mauling lasted for half an hour under a hot sun. When all five were bloodied and still, the commandant stepped forward and announced a new rule. If a prisoner escaped, then 10 of his comrades would be whipped and left to die in the sun. Needless to say, the demonstration curtailed many escape schemes that had been in the works. Clay found a Filipino scout who was working as a truck driver and had managed to establish a black market for food within the American section of O'Donnell. His prices were fair, and he offered tins of salmon, sardines, and tuna, along with peanut butter, fruit, and cookies. Pete and Clay made a decision. They would take the cash hidden in Pete's canteen cover, buy the food they could afford, share it between themselves but include no one else, and try to survive. The scheme would take both of their efforts because it was difficult to hide and eat black market food. Everyone was ravenous and watching everyone else. They felt lousy hiding and not sharing, but they damned sure could not feed the 60,000 starving souls at O'Donnell. Clay's first haul was a tin of salmon, 4 oranges, and 2 coconut cookies. And for $1.50, they ate like kings. The plan was to stretch the money as far as possible, and when it was gone, they would think of something else. The extra food energized Pete, and he began roaming the prison looking for his old friends from the 26th Cavalry. The Japanese rarely entered the camp and had little interest in what went on there. They knew the conditions were inhumane and deteriorating, but they simply ignored the prisoners when possible. As long as they remained locked up and worked when they were instructed, the Japanese didn't seem to care. However, the piles of dead bodies could not be ignored. The commandant ordered that they be burned, but General King pleaded for a more respectful burial. The Japanese might believe in cremation, but the Americans did not. With the Americans dying at a rate of 100 per day, General King organized burying rituals. Groups of gravediggers took turns at the shovel, while other groups hauled the bodies. Most came from the morgue at the hospital, but there were decomposing bodies all over the prison. Pete and Clay learned that those who stayed busy lived longer than those who sat around in a stupor, so they volunteered to dig. They left the barracks after breakfast and walked to the American cemetery, just outside the main camp, about 800 yards from the hospital. They were handed their tools, old spades and pieces of metal bent here and there, and barely able to scratch up a pound of dirt. An American officer stepped off the boundaries of the next mass grave, 6 feet wide, 20 feet long, 4 feet deep. The diggers began their work. There were dozens of them, and the work was urgent because the bodies were rotting. They arrived in blankets strung between bamboo poles or on litters fashioned from old doors. The burial parties used anything that would haul a 100-pound skeleton, many of which had begun decomposing in the heat. The rotting corpses emitted a noxious odor that stung when inhaled. At each grave, a registration officer handled the paperwork and recorded the name and exact location of each man as he was laid to rest. However, some of the dead had no dog tags and were unknown. Each grave held 20 or more men. When one was filled, the gravediggers went about the glum business of covering their comrades. The cemetery was nicknamed the Boneyard, and how fitting that became. Pete could count the ribs on virtually every corpse he buried, and he never failed to utter a curse at the Japanese as he covered each American soldier. Day after day, he and Clay volunteered to dig graves. For Pete, it was a way to hang on to his humanity. Someone had to make sure each soldier received a proper burial, or at least the best under the circumstances. If Pete died, he would do so with the assurance that some kind soul had dug a real grave for him. As the casualties mounted, the digging became more intense. And with lousy tools and straining energy, the work was difficult. The boneyard expanded as more graves were necessary. The pallbearers arrived in a steady stream. A grave was filled, and an officer ordered it closed. Pete and Clay and four others began the chore of backfilling, of covering the men. As Pete did so, he stopped cold. Below him, just a few feet away, was a face he recognized, even with its closed eyes and thick black whiskers. He asked the registration officer for the name. Salvador Moreno of the 26th Cavalry. Pete closed his eyes and stood motionless. You okay, Pete? Clay asked. Pete backed away from the grave and stumbled a few feet to a fence post. He sat down, covered his face with his hands, and wept bitterly. Chapter 29. As things developed, the grave digging was not such a good idea after all. The Japanese were watching from a distance. They needed some of the healthier Americans to ship back to Japan to work as slave laborers in coal mines. Pete and Clay were chosen in a group of about 1,000. The first hint of change came after breakfast in late June when a guard appeared and ordered 5 men from their barracks to follow him. At the parade ground, they formed lines and stood at attention. A convoy of trucks arrived, and as each man boarded, he was given a rice ball, a banana, and a can of water. Pete and Clay knew that this was not a normal work detail, and as they rode for more than an hour, some excitement crept into the conversations around them. Could it be possible they were leaving O'Donnell for good? The Japanese were constantly moving prisoners around, and wherever they were going had to be an improvement over O'Donnell. Soon they were entering the busy streets of Manila, and speculation ran wild about their destination. When they stopped at the harbor, the men were confused. Should they be delighted that O'Donnell was behind them, or terrified of being shipped to Japan? Before long, all excitement vanished. They were herded onto a dock and began waiting. A group of prisoners from another camp arrived and spread the gossip that the Red Cross had negotiated a prisoner exchange and that they were headed to Australia and freedom. By that time, though, Pete and the men from O'Donnell believed nothing. As they waited, Pete stared at the freighter, an ancient rusting vessel with no markings whatsoever, no name, no registration, no nationality. Finally, they queued up in a long line and began to slowly climb the gangway. On board, They passed the forward bulkhead and came to an open hatch with a ladder down to the hold. Guards were nervous and barking commands. As Pete began to step down into the hold, he was hit with a vile odor from below. As he descended farther, he saw the sweaty faces of hundreds of prisoners already on board. As he would learn, about 1,200 men had been loaded from a prison north of Manila, and they had been informed by the guards that they were headed to Japan to work in the coal mines. As more prisoners were stuffed into the hold, the men began to suffocate. They were shoulder to shoulder, body to body, with no room to sit, lie, or even move about. They began shouting and cursing, and all order broke down. The guards kept stuffing more men below, beating the reluctant ones with rifle butts. The temperature rose to 100 degrees, and men began fainting, but there was no room to fall. Soon, they were dying. The Emperor Hirohito refused to ratify the Geneva Convention, and from the beginning of its war in Asia, his imperial army treated its captured prisoners as slaves. With a severe shortage of labor at home, the Japanese devised a grand scheme to ship American POWs to the coal mines on their mainland. To do so, they used every available cargo vessel, regardless of age and seaworthiness. All ships were commissioned and stuffed with soldiers bound for the Philippines, and then restuffed with sick and dying American boys bound for the labor camps. Throughout the war, 125,000 Allied prisoners were shipped to Japan, with 21,000 dying on board or going down with the ships. On August 6, 1945, 400 American POWs were underground digging for coal in a mine near Omine, only 50 miles from Hiroshima. When the first atomic bomb landed, the ground rolled and shook, and they knew it was something far beyond the usual daily bombings. They fervently prayed it was the beginning of the end. Among their many great miscalculations in the war, the Japanese failed to build enough boats to haul troops and supplies. Added to this was their failure to eliminate the U.S. submarine fleet at Pearl Harbor and elsewhere during the early days of the war. By the summer of 1942, U.S. subs were roaming like lone wolves in the South Pacific and feasting on Japanese merchant ships. To overcompensate, the Japanese simply crammed more of their soldiers onto their ships to go fight and more of their POWs to bring home to work. Their freighters were perpetually overloaded, slow, outdated, easily stocked, and unmarked. They were known as hell ships. Between January of 1942 and July of 1945, the Japanese hauled 156 loads of war prisoners to the mainland to work in labor camps, and the voyages were worse than any abuse the Americans had yet to encounter. Locked below deck with no food, water, lights, toilets, or breathable air, the men succumbed to fainting, madness, and death. And torpedoes. Because the Japanese did not mark their troop carriers, they were fair game for Allied submarines. An estimated 5,000 American POWs crammed into the holds of Japanese freighters were killed by American torpedoes. Pete's ship left Manila Bay 6 hours after he boarded, and men around him were already suffocating and screaming. The guards mercifully opened the portholes, and a whiff of air spread through the hold. A colonel managed to convince a guard that men were dying, and what good was a slave if he arrived dead? The hatches were opened, and the prisoners were allowed to climb to the deck, where they could at least breathe and see the moon. Fresh air was plentiful. Food and water were not mentioned. Guards stood gun to gun, waiting to shoot any poor prisoner who tried to vault into the sea. Though suicide was a constant thought, no one had the energy. Pete and Clay spent the night on the deck, with hundreds of others, under a brilliant sky that back home would have been admired. Now, though, it was just another reminder of how far they were from freedom. Evidently, the guards had been instructed to kill only when necessary. Slave labor was now deemed valuable, and the fact that men were dying below was unacceptable. At dawn, dead bodies were lifted from the hold and shoved up the ladder and buried unceremoniously at sea. Pete watched them hit the water, then float for a moment before disappearing, and with each one he thought of the mother and father and young wife back home in Oregon or Minnesota or Florida, who were at that moment saying their prayers and waiting for a letter. How long would it be before a man in uniform knocked on the door and shattered their world? The sun was up, and there was no shade on the deck. No shade, no food, no water. And the prisoners complained to the guards more and more with each passing hour. The guards kept their fingers on their triggers and returned the curses in their language. As the day wore on, so did the nerves and tension. Finally, a prisoner ran for the railing, took a flying leap, and dove for the ocean, 80 feet below. He landed with a splash and in a hail of gunfire. The Japs, while proficient with swords and bayonets, were notoriously bad shots, and it was not possible to know if the prisoner was hit. However, the prolonged volley that followed him down was enough to discourage more diving. Hours passed as the men baked in the sun. To escape it, they went below for brief respites, but the stench was so overwhelming they could not last. Most were still suffering from dysentery, and the guards allowed them to hang by ropes off the stern and bow to discharge their bloody diarrhea. Anything to keep it off board. Mercifully, some clouds arrived late in the afternoon of the second day and blocked the sun. The prisoners were ordered below and were promised that food would be served before long. They loitered in long lines to avoid the descent into hell, and the guards seemed somewhat sympathetic and didn't push them. Darkness came with no hint of food. Suddenly, there was a panic among the guards. Some were running from the bow, yakking in extreme agitation for no apparent reason. The first torpedo hit in the rear by the engine room. The second hit perfectly in the middle. Both explosions rocked the ship. Its steel frame echoed and vibrated. It was an old boat that wouldn't last long. And even Pete, a cavalry guy who had grown up landlocked, knew they would sink fast. He and Clay squatted on the deck and watched as the panicked guards slammed the hatches, sealing over 1,800 Americans below. About 100 remained on deck, and the guards were suddenly unconcerned with them. The ship was going down. It was every man for himself. A prisoner, one braver than the others, ran forward and attempted to open a hatch. A guard shot him in the back of the head and kicked his body aside. So much for heroism. A third torpedo knocked the men off their feet, and total chaos ensued. The guards frantically unhitched rubber rafts and tossed life vests into the sea. Prisoners vaulted over the sides and into a black ocean with no idea where they might land. As Pete and Clay scurried to a railing, they passed a guard who had laid down his rifle while he struggled with a raft. Pete instinctively grabbed it, shot the son of a bitch in the face, tossed the rifle over the side, then jumped and followed it to the water, laughing as he fell. The landing was hard, but the water was warm. Clay fell nearby, and they began dog paddling and looking for something to hold on to. The sea was pitch black, and everywhere men were crying for help, both in English and in Japanese. The ship began exploding, and Pete could hear the anguished cries of those trapped. He swam away from it as fast as his fatigued and depleted limbs could take him. For a second, he lost Clay, and he called for him.
Over here, Clay called back. I've got a raft.
They scrambled into what appeared to be a 6-man raft, and as soon as they caught their breath, Clay said,
You shot that son of a bitch.
I did,
Pete said proudly,
and with his own gun.
They heard Japanese voices on the water and went silent. Using the small oars they found in a pocket, along with a flare but no food or water, they paddled furiously away while watching the ship list and begin to sink. The distant screams were sickening. For 10, 15, 20 minutes they paddled, and when their escape was certain, they stopped and rested. 1,000 yards away, the ship tilted abruptly on its stern and sank in a matter of seconds. By locking the hatches, the guards had killed another 1,800 sick and starving American boys. From the blackness of the sea, a voice called out, and it was not in English. Pete and Clay slid down into the raft and waited. Before long, they heard a thump against the raft. Then a head popped up. They grabbed the guard and pulled him into their raft. Like most Japs, he was tiny, 5'5" max, 120 pounds, and without a bayonet or sword or rifle, he looked much smaller. He had no canteen, no backpack, no food or water. So he was a worthless Jap, who only minutes earlier had been tormenting his prisoners. Clay punched him so hard, his jaw cracked. They took turns punching and strangling him, and when the Jap stopped breathing, they tossed him into the ocean, where he would rest forever with their brothers he had just killed. And they felt good. In spite of their dehydration and hunger, and in spite of drifting in a raft and having no idea where they were, they felt an immense satisfaction. They had finally struck back, drawn blood, killed the enemy, turned the tide in favor of the Allies. For the first time in weeks, they were free. There were no brutal guards with guns or bayonets watching them. They were not digging burial trenches. There were no dead bodies stacked around them. They were adrift under a clear, star-filled sky, with no idea which direction held the most promise. So they laid down the paddles and rested on a calm sea. The South China Sea was a busy place, and tomorrow, someone would find them. The first boat was a Japanese frigate, and as soon as Pete recognized the flag, he and Clay slid out of the raft and hid under it. The ship seemed unconcerned with the empty raft and never slowed down. It appeared to be going in the direction of the wreck, probably searching for Japanese survivors. Pete and Clay had vowed to drown themselves before being captured again. The second boat was a 40-foot Filipino fishing rig owned by a man named Amado and manned by him and his two sons, three of the nicest people on the face of the earth. When they realized that Pete and Clay were Americans, they pulled them aboard, wrapped them in blankets, and handed them water at first, then hot black coffee, a delicacy they had not had in months. As Teofilo partially deflated the raft and hid it, Tomas captained the boat, while Amato peppered the Americans with questions. Where were they from? Where were they imprisoned? For how long? He had a cousin in California and loved America. His brother was a Filipino scout who was hiding in the mountains. Amato hated the Japanese even more than Pete and Clay did. Where were they headed? Since they had no idea where they were, they certainly had no destination. Amato said they were about 20 miles from land. He said that last week, the Americans had torpedoed another ship filled with their own soldiers. Why were they doing this? Pete explained that the troop ships were unmarked. Teofilo served them bowls of hot rice with pandesal, a fluffy roll that was the national bread. They had eaten it before the war and thought little of it. Now, though, it was manna from heaven, with a little butter added. While they ate, Anamato cautioned them to eat slowly because it was easy to overwhelm their fragile systems. Teofilo grilled small fillets of mackerel and milkfish in a skillet on a portable gas grill. Pete and Clay knew to eat slowly. Starvation had been a way of life for the past 6 months, and they had learned too much about it. But they struggled to control their desire to stuff their mouths. With his first bite of the warm fish, Pete hardly chewed, and he smiled as it descended wonderfully to his stomach. Amato was under contract to the Japanese Army to deliver his catch each day, so it was important that they go about their business. They worked their lines, catching yellowfin tuna, salmon, and ruby snapper, while Pete and Clay slept for hours in the cabin. When they awoke, they ate more rice and fish and drank water by the gallon. At dusk, as Tomas mopped the deck and put away the rods, Amato opened a fruit jar filled with a fermented rice home brew and poured it into their empty coffee cups. It was bitter and tasteless, and not something Pete would ever find at the Peabody Bar. But it was potent, and the alcohol hit fast and hard. By the second serving, Pete and Clay were giddy. They were free, well-fed for the first time since Christmas, and happily getting buzzed on a home brew that improved with each sip. Amato's home was the small fishing village of San Narciso on the west coast of the Luzon Peninsula. By land, Manila was 4 hours away, or five or six depending on the roads, mountain paths, and ferries. By sea, it was 3 hours, and the route curved around Bataan, the last place they wanted to see. Amato said Manila was crawling with Japanese, and they should stay away. He would not take his boat there. Late in the day, when San Narciso came into view, Tomas reduced the engine to an idle. It was time for a serious discussion. There would be Japanese at the harbor waiting for their fish, but they were cooks, not soldiers, and they would not inspect the boat. Pete and Clay would be safe to sleep on the boat that night, but tomorrow they must move on. If they were seen or caught, Amato and his sons would lose their boat and probably their heads. Their first option was to escape, and Amato had a friend they could talk to. But escape meant a long voyage across open seas in a bad boat, and Amato didn't like the odds. Since the war started, he knew of several Americans who had tried it. No one knew if they were successful. Plus, there was the issue of compensation, and most of the prisoners were penniless. Pete assured him that they were too. The second option was to fight. Amato had contacts who could take the men into the mountains where the guerrillas were operating. There were a lot of Americans and Filipino scouts organized in the dense jungles of Luzon. They were hitting the enemy from all directions, at times seriously disrupting the movements of troops and supplies. The Imperial Army had declared war on the guerrillas and was offering bounties. The situation was beyond dangerous. "We're not running away," Pete said. "We came here to fight." "And we have some scores to settle," Clay added. Amato smiled and nodded his agreement. He was a proud Filipino and sickened by the Japanese invasion. If he could somehow poison his fish to kill enemy soldiers, he would gladly do so. He prayed that the Americans would one day prevail and free his country, and he longed for that moment. With the harbor in sight, Pete and Clay went below deck and hid in the cabin. At the pier, Tomas and Teofilo removed the heavy tin crates filled with their catch and waited for their only customer. A short, fat Japanese man in a bloodied apron approached without a hello or any greeting, and inspected their fish. He made an offer, one that Amato laughed at. His counteroffer was rejected outright. And this went on, back and forth, the same ritual every afternoon. The cook was in too much of a hurry to weigh the fish. He made his final offer, one that Amato really could not reject, and the deal was done. Money changed hands, and from the look on Amato's face, he had been shortchanged again. Two privates arrived with a wagon, loaded the fish, and left while the cook was bargaining with the captain of the next fishing boat. When they were gone, Teofilo fired up his grill again and prepared dinner. The menu was the same: boiled rice, hot buttered pandesal, and grilled mackerel fillets. It had been 10 hours since their breakfast, and neither Pete nor Clay felt sick from overeating. They had consumed a light lunch, been through a couple of cocktail hours with the homebrew, and so far, their traumatized bodies were holding up well. When they had been starved, all they thought about was food. Now that it was available and the gnawing hunger pains were gone, their thoughts drifted elsewhere. Amato instructed them to stay in the cabin, regardless of how hot and humid it became. The harbor would be deserted throughout the night, but no one could be trusted. If a deckhand or some kid on a bike saw two Americans on a fishing boat, that information could be sold to the Japanese. The three packed their rucksacks and said goodnight. Wisely, Amato took the home brew with him. The Americans had had enough. It wasn't long before the cabin was suffocating. Pete cracked the door and took a peek. The harbor was pitch black. The boat next to them was a silhouette. The only sounds were of the water gently splashing against the boats. "It's clear out here," he said, and Clay joined him. They kept low and still on the deck. When they talked, and it wasn't often, they whispered. There were a few lights in the town, but they saw not a single person moving about. In the cabin, there was a small basin. Next to it was a bar of soap that had evidently been shrinking for some time. Pete took it, broke it cleanly in two, and handed Clay his portion. Pete stripped naked, eased over the side of the boat, and without a sound, entered the water. He assumed it was polluted and filthy, like all harbors, but he didn't care. He squeezed every possible bubble out of his soap and bathed in luxury. When he finished, Clay tossed down his shirt, pants, and socks, and he washed them for the first time in months. They were rags, but he had nothing else. At some point, they had no idea of the hour, the heat broke suddenly, and a gentle wind brought relief. They retreated to the cabin and locked the door. They were tempted to sleep on the deck, under the stars, but the fear of being seen was too great. So far, they had survived everything a brutal war could throw at them. It would be a tragedy to get caught by a kid on a bike. The date was around June 20th. They weren't sure. There was no calendar in the cabin, and they had not seen one in months. After a while, a starving prisoner stops worrying about the date. They had surrendered on April 10th. Pete had marched up the Bataan Peninsula for 6 days. For Clay, it had been 5. They had spent approximately 2 months at O'Donnell, and thinking of that miserable hellhole made them cringe. But they had survived it, as they had the death march, the siege of Bataan, the fighting, the surrender, the packed rail cars, the hell ships, along with starvation and disease and death scenes they could never forget. They marveled at the human body's ability to endure and the spirit's resourcefulness in the face of deprivation. They had survived. The war was not over, but certainly they had seen the worst of it. They were no longer captives, and now they would soon be on equal footing with the enemy. With the issue of food temporarily behind them, They talked about their wives and families. They desperately wanted to write letters and send them home. They would discuss it with Amato in the morning.